Session number 11210, reel 3.
Mr. A.H. Watcham, Reel 3. Germany, Mr. Watcham.
Yeah, well, I was captured very early in the morning, around about 6-ish, at a place called Bali, around about the 20th of May, 21st of May. And then we set off column-wise, and we were joined every day by further columns, French, Belgian, you know, we were a mixed crowd. And the Tommies were kept together, of course, and then we were subject to all sorts of, well, queer attitude with the Germans. They kept halting us, and then we had to run and catch up the French, who were then given them transport, and then the Belgians were given transport. And I think this was done with the idea of setting one against the other.
But, did it work?
Not really, no. I think everybody was, you're in a state of shock, let's be honest about it. And, you know, when you saw the thousands of these, you know, in the northern part of France, these columns snaking over hills and what seemed endless, and German transports going the other way, fully equipped, you know, despite all the propaganda, fully armed, you know, belting towards the Channel coast, as we learned later.
Did they shout at you as they went
by? No, they hadn't time. The only time I was stopped, we stayed overnight in the town of Albert, which I think there's a story from the First World War about the Golden Cross, you know, and something. But this was on an aerodrome, and I remember seeing literally thousands of packages of plane wings and engines waiting to be assembled. They'd already started putting crosses on them, you know. This stuff had been shipped over, you know, you just couldn't believe the wastage, you know.
And how far would you march each day with the rest of it?
Between 20 and 30 kilometres each day.
And how were you fed?
As best you could. Off the land, or scrounged it, you know. And now and again they would stop, give you bread, but, you know, it was do as best as you could sort of thing. Then we came to Cambrai, which I can see it yet. It just looked like... was it Macbeth, you know, when they all put branches and leaves and it appeared to be walking. Well, this city or town appeared to be just a mass of white, like one big white flower. And as we got into the streets, we found all the citizens had rolled out sheets and pillowcases and this and the other. And we understood that was a surrender so that the town wouldn't be damaged. That's what we felt. And it was there that I encountered the first Germans. I couldn't speak German then, but there were three or four, and they were very young fellows. And I remember them stopping me and saying, what was it? It's a long way to Tipperary, Tommy, you know, Tommy. I said, no, I didn't answer them. And they said, but it's a much longer way to Berlin on foot. I always remember. And that was the only time I really kicked to give me a, not that it wasn't serious, but helped me on my way sort of thing. But that was the first incident, and you learned then what humiliation was, and you couldn't retaliate, you see. Then we just kept moving, and as I say, we stayed by the roadside overnight or in barns and all sorts of places, and crossed the Belgian frontier to a town called Bertrix, I think it's B-R-T-R-I-X, I remember, and that was where they had trains. This was way well behind the lines then, of course. And then we were put on trains, into trucks, and through the Siegfried to the town of Trier, or Treves, I think is the French version. And we arrived there about 2 o'clock in the morning. I remember this quite vividly. The town was like Blackpool illumination. It was quite fantastic. You know, we'd been used to sort of lighting restrictions at home, blackouts, and this town was just absolutely a massive light, and all the streets, they had these long Nazi swastika flags draped from the windows up in these 34-storey buildings. The only thing missing was ticker tape, sort of thing. And they marched us up and down there, because we were in a right state now. This was about, what date would this be? About the 5th of June. So we'd been marching
and
about...
And we made a spectacle for...
I think so. I'm sure it was. The only thing missing were the chains, sort of, you know, like the Romans used to bring them back. But I'm sure that was what it was for.
And what was the reaction of the inhabitants, as you...
Well, we could hear the radios. I didn't know it now, with this Sondermeldung, you see. And as each French town fell, you see, there was a blare of martial music and Sondermeldung, a special report, sort of thing, you see. And then we wound our way up this long hill right to this these barracks at the top of this huge hill, and there were literally thousands of prisoners. It sounds terrible, but I remember asking where the toilets were. And they pointed at these toilets, because this was a caserne, a barrack. And the toilets were just full. It was terrible, the smell, the stench. And this was June, of course. And I remember picking up a tin or a bowl or something, hoping to get some food. And I joined this huge, long queue. And, you know, I know what it's like to be hungry. And I got right to the window, and it was Nick's mare, Tommy. The shutter went down. You know, where are you going to get your next bite to eat from? I remember following two Tommies, and I'm sure they were members of the Pioneer Corps, because this was a branch of the Royal Engineers, and these were all reservists that were called up. Many of them had served in the First World War, and here they were out in France and captured, and they were eating bread, and one of them, I presumed, had either no teeth or false teeth, and they couldn't eat the hard crusts. And I actually crawled on my hands and knees and picked up crusts to keep myself from going too hungry.
And did the Germans get food to you?
Yes, as best they could. They had these kitchens open, but I didn't get any, but other people did. Then the rumours were rife then, of course, where we were going. The rumour was Poland. And I remember a Geordie fella coming to me and saying, we're going to Poland, land of wolves and bears. That was all he could envisage, was ice and snow and wolves and bears, sort of thing. Well, because then we didn't know, you see. And the next morning we were marched down to the big railway station. Every time I see these Holocaust films, you know, this brings it back to me. You didn't think about it then, but these marshalling yards, you know, and these truck after truck. And you climbed into these things and the doors went clang, you know, and there you were, 60 men packed inside there. June, it was very hot. Two little grills. I remember one end of the wagon and the other one at the other side. And it was so bad in there, we used to take shifts to go and get a gulp of fresh air. Now, we were in there 48 hours. And that's
what
a long time.
What did you do for food and for toiletry?
Would you like the gruesome detail? There wasn't any. You just had with you, you know, we were given bread and that sort of thing, but we were let out once, and that was at a place called, I think it was either Posen or Schneidermühl, which if you look on your map isn't far from Torren, which was our eventual destination, and there we were fed and watered to a degree by German Red Cross, who told us that we were nearly to the end of our destination.
So toiletry, you just had to hold it
off? Oh, best you could.
There was no bucket or anything in the.
No, I don't recall
truck.
It. No, we had three fellows who were off a destroyer. They'd been blown out into the water, and they'd swallowed gallons of salt water, and they were in a dreadful state. They had tantamount to dysentery. Dreadful. Three of them. They were in an awful state. But there again, we didn't know anybody, and you know, we were all just packed in, and that was it. No friendships were formed then, you know. You just, I remember looking out, you know, through the cracks. I remember seeing a German family. This may sound very naive again, but you know, it strikes home when you're like, they were picnicking. You could see them on this beautiful countryside, and I thought, you know, what a contrast. how your life can change.
How had the German guards treated you throughout this long journey?
Well, they didn't bother us very much. They hadn't much time for us, really. They were shipping us out, you see. You must remember the collapse of France and Belgium. Well, there were thousands and thousands of us to get away from the front and ship us into Germany. And, of course, as I said, you know, they shipped us as far away as they could. You know, Poland was a mighty long way from France.
Had there been any attempts at escaping?
Oh, yes. Fellows escaped from the line of march, but I didn't hear a great deal about that. We were pretty well guarded. That was my experience. And, of course, we were tired. We were hungry. And where were we to go? The collapse was so quick, so sudden.
And when you got to your first German camp, where was that?
It's quite a big town, the town of Thorn.
You know what date that was?
It must have been round about, let me see, about the 9th, 10th of June.
And how far had you come then?
Well, we crossed Germany, literally. I found out afterwards we came through the town of Erfurt, right up to Posen Schneidermühle, which is in what the Germans call Wattergau. That's one of the most eastern provinces of the German Reich then, and then into the corridor, of course. Thorn was on the River Vistula, quite a biggish town. I did learn afterwards, so I actually saw the house. I think it said that Napoleon slept there on the way to the Battle of Jena, if you're a historian. All I thought was, tough luck, Napoleon.
What was the camp like?
Well, actually, we arrived in this, again, in this marshalling yard, and the strange thing was, when they opened these doors, it was like prison, these cattle truck doors opened, and we were all blinking in the sunlight, and we heard a band playing, and they were playing Roll Out the Battle, which was a Tommy's marching tune, but of course, I think it's an Austrian tune, or it's a German tune anyway, different words. We thought the only thing missing was a red carpet. There was the band playing. Of course, again, they marched us through the street, and then we went into this huge, it's an old Polish fort, I believe, and it had, behind it was a big Polish aerodrome, I learned later. And these huge gates swung open, and we went into this place, and there were all these big bunkers, you know, places where they housed us.
Oh. What was the accommodation like?
Oh, we slept cheek to cheek, do they say? In these long huts on straw. They had these boards up, and there was just a mass of straw in there, and you just slept along there. I think it was about 200 or something. But nobody still, we didn't have any close friends. No, we knew people. We obviously met people out of our own regiment, but nothing was organised as yet. And this is where I had my first taste of German ersatz coffee. And, you know, when you're hungry and thirsty, when the cry went up, coffee, you know, we all dashed down the hill. God, coffee at last. Not that I'm a coffee drinker, I'm a real Englishman. I like a cup of tea. And God, when they gave us this coffee, if you've ever tasted or heard of ersatz coffee, it was foul stuff, but it was hot. I think that's about all you could say about it. Then after that, we got a regular hot meal in the daytime, you know, soup, the usual.
What time was reveille?
There wasn't such a thing as reveille, if my memory serves me rightly. Some of us were up half the night because we were sick, many of us, some dysentery. Some very bad cases of dysentery by this time. I remember seeing chaps wheeled away on these sort of trundle carts, you know, absolutely out.
Were you getting any medical attention?
Well, they were taken to a lazaret, a hospital, which was further down the line, not very, very far away. I think it was attached to the aerodrome, I'm not sure about that, but certainly they went away for medical treatment. But, of course, by this time, too, we were getting a little bit of exercise, and the weather was good, of course, it was June, you see, and we were getting food fairly regularly, and we were actually allowed to go out on working parties into the town of Thorn, working on building site, you know, there was still rubble there, you know, there was still clearing up jobs to be done, and that we got paid for that, and we could buy bread.
How much were you paid?
I really can't remember, it was just a nominal sum, I think. You could always tell a man who had been out working because he always looked pregnant, because he always had his bread underneath his pullover or his jersey, because he treasured that, you know, and there was so much thieving and pilfering going on because men were hungry, you see.
So there were stealing going on.
Well, if it's worth the anecdote, the chap I slept next to was a Jew. I think he came from Gateshead. And I remember he would mortar the bugger that tried to pinch his bread, you see. And because he should never issue threats like that. Because I remember he must have lain on it through the night as a pillow. And when he got up the next morning, somebody cut both ends off. It clear as a whistle while he slept.
Were you all working, or was it just...
Oh, no, just...
Selected groups?
Well, you know, you could report and go out, but not...
And was this
I only went
you,
out once.
Was this something that you looked forward to doing?
Not really, because we didn't know what was happening, really. But by this time, of course, we'd had a haircut. I had all my hair shaved off. And I was consoled by the fact that hair that's cut like this always grows again. But you see, we were undernourished, and I still attribute that a lot to my hair falling out very rapidly. Yeah, we looked dreadful. I remember the bro. You went in one end. It was like a cattle market. You went in one end and you came out the other. Absolutely Kojak's time. Bald as a coot. And of course, we were filthy dirty, you know, and emaciated in many ways. And we weren't, you know, we hadn't built ourselves up in a dirty, filthy uniform. And this, I remember they stuck this thing around my neck, a big plate with 7767. That was my POW number. And these were photographs for identification purposes. Well, it's crazy when you think about it, because within 3 or 4 months, we'd got Red Cross razors and shaving gear, and we trimmed ourselves up a little bit better, and our hair started to grow again a bit. And, you know, how they could identify us from these, I never know. But it was rough time. We were very often humiliated. The worst humiliation was nitpicking, you know. I didn't know what a louse was. I mean, I had a very, very tender upbringing. I wouldn't say I wasn't cotton wool, but I mean, lice and that were alien to me in that sense. And I remember a fellow asked me, had I any lice, you know, and I didn't know what he was talking about, but we obviously had. And the German, particularly officers, used to come round, and many of them had their lady friends with us. And there we were, sitting on this horrible straw, probably bare buff to the waist sort of thing, you know, nitpicking and trying to keep yourself clean. It was a bit humiliating. And they took all our uniforms off us, gave us odds and sods things. I had a Polish hat. Have you ever seen these diamonds? Yeah, they all funny. And I remember the coat they gave me must have belonged to a camel driver, because it was like a woman's corset. It was tight as a... right down to my waist, and then it was sort of a splayed skirt. I looked an absolute freak in it, actually. But that was all they gave us till we got our uniforms back. I think we would clean them till I was in, yes.
Did they take them right to clean?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But
what was the camp number?
This was Stalag 20A in Torren. The bridges was. I remember the only time I went out, the bridges were still down. There'd been quite a bit of damage in the town.
You mentioned bread. What other food did you get?
Well, we get soup, you know, German
and how
sausage.
Often a day did you get a meal?
Once a day.
You got one main meal a day?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what about the other early sessions? Did you try and save meal or food or what?
Well, yeah, when you're hungry, you eat, and that's it. And as I say, sometimes if you did manage to get out to work, you could augment your food. But it was very unreliable, that. But we weren't there all that long either. I remember the other thing they did there, which was quite amusing to us. This little fellow got up on his... I remember he was so small, he had to get a stand on a barrel. I think he was an Oberst, a major, and he told us about the fall of Paris, and we just couldn't believe this, that Paris had fallen. You know, we knew that that we'd been defeated, we were in trouble, but Paris to fall. And he said we'd be home in 2 or 3 weeks, you know, and the cat calls, oh, I remember shouting him down. And then they segregated us. They wanted the English here, and the Welsh, and the Irish, and the Scots. Which was ridiculous when you think about it. It was their idea of trying to probably antagonised, I don't know, but it didn't work, and they soon abandoned the idea. And then we found we were shipped out of this stalag onto working commandos.
And how long was this? When was this happening?
Well, this was about the 27th of June. That's the date I've got in my diary, 27th of June.
What was a working commando?
Well, again, from what I gather, you see, we were Wehrmacht property. We were the property of the German forces. And we were hired out to firms, you see. And they put us into these working camps. And out of these camps, we marched out to the various working sections on this. It turned out to be a huge, almost like a trading estate. That's what it was. Bromberg was just down the line from Torun. It was a very short strip. Bydgoszcz was the Polish name, and this was where the Germans crossed the frontier on Blutsonntag, as they called it. There was a lot of atrocities apparently happening in this town.
What was the camp like?
It was an old Arbeitsdienst, you know, the youth labour corps. It belonged to them. So the camp was in pretty good nick. It was clean. A triangular shape with a parade ground. It's all sand, of course. In Poland, the northern part of Pomerania and Poland is very sandy. But the huts were all round and barbed wire, of course. But we didn't have these tower things that most of the prison camps had.
Machine gun towers?
Yes, we didn't have them. There were only, I think there were two camps, one adjacent to the other, but they formed one camp.
And how many prisoners were in these?
We were about 1,000 altogether, 20 men in a room.
And how many guards would you have?
That I really couldn't tell you, but they had guards patrolling outside, and then they had their own little barrack room, and these guards took us to work. And there would be one guard with 20 men on a working party, with one English sergeant or corporal in charge as far as we were concerned. They didn't work, though.
It was 20 to a hut, and what were you sleeping in?
We were sleeping on double bunks with hard wooden slats across, and I think we had a sheet and a blanket, I think. One of the funny things that, you know, you're talking about the Germans giving us things. They could never understand why we couldn't eat sauerkraut, for example. Well, sauerkraut was literally alien to most Tommies there. I think you would agree with that. Then we were working on these railways. This was the main line, I think, from Berlin right through Warsaw. I'm not sure even right to Vladivostok, but it was a main line, and it had us what they call stopping. We had these big wooden sort of picks, you know, and we had to ram the stones underneath the sleepers, you know. This was where they'd repair the rails, you know. And they issued us with clogs, Holzschuh. Well, again, you know, I knew what clogs were. I'd never worn clogs in my life. But they insisted that we wear these clogs. Now, I must admit, they were warm. The wood was very warm. But they also issued us with what the Germans called Fußlappen. Lappen, that's a real Geordie word, isn't it? You know, it's funny how the German words often relate to your own dialect. And it was a square of flannelette, which you laid over your clog, your Holzschuh, and then you put your foot into it and wrapped this round, and it was very, very warm and very comfortable, really. But you know, you've heard these hunting horns that they blow at the football matches now. Well, there was always a man on duty with his hunting horn when there's an express or a train approaching. Have you ever tried to run in clogs that you'd never worn? You know, we fell over rail, we did all sorts, and in the end we protested. We asked that we would be allowed to wear our own army boots. And to our amazement, the Germans agreed. But it was dangerous. They were warm, they were comfortable, and we wore them in the camp. So then we got home at night, we took our shoes off and put these on shoes.
Have the food situation improved?
Well, by this time, of course, we had a proper soup kitchen. So we got one good hot meal a day. Well, good. Potatoes and cabbage and a bit of horse meat. But it was hot and it filled your belly, and you know, after a day's work it was worth it. And then we got a third of a loaf of bread, and we would get sausage. We would get a ring of sausage, you know, with 20 men, you know, you had to get a micrometer screw almost to portion it out. So we decided in our wisdom to give one man that and now a feast, and then he had a famine for 19 days and his subjects came back the next day.
Was there any problems with the sharing out of food?
Sometimes if the knife didn't go quite right, you know, but I never encountered it. When you're booked in too, you see. You know.
Had Red Cross arrived?
It didn't come for quite some time, and then only one parcel between 20 men.
Was the hygiene situation any better in this camp?
Yes, this was quite a well-planned camp. As I say, we were in rooms, 20 men to a room. There were duck boards outside, because in the winter time, you know, it could get pretty rough. And I remember along from the hut I was in, there were showers. And then right next to the showers were toilets. Now, it was the old wooden structure, but they were clean. Certainly not flush toilets, but they were clean and looked after. We kept them clean ourselves, of course. And then we had a cookhouse, and there were two big, what do you call them, soup things, you know. And then we had a recreation room.
Did you have your own cooks? Yes.
They were, and they got supplies in. And we got a third of a loaf of bread a day. And in the early, very early stage, they used to bring baskets of bread out to us, because then we were working 12, 14 hours a day. Yeah, I think I say, for quite a period, I never saw the camp in daylight. Because by this time, you see, we'd get...
How did day start?
6 o'clock in the morning. I've got it in my diary here, Rivali, 6 o'clock, sometimes 7, depended. We didn't work Sundays. And we got a bottle of beer on Hitler's birthday, I remember that. And I didn't drink beer, so I wouldn't, you know, it didn't worry me. Then we began to pick up little snippets of news. One of our chaps, he was a corporal, he could speak a little German. And his Schachmeister, he's over, you know, foreman, we understood was a communist. He'd been in Red Square, you could tell you all about the big parades and something like that. And he used to tell us bits of news. We knew about Hess before the German guards did. You know, when he landed in Scotland.
And this was coming from this chap, was it?
Yeah.
You didn't have a radio?
No. But, you know, in the camp, of course, any news was fastened on, you see. And the fellow said, have you heard about Hess, you see? No, you know, everybody. And one of the guards apparently heard the name Hess and wondered what we were talking about. So this poor old corporal was hauled in front of the hauptmann, the captain, and asked to explain him. And I understand, I'm not sure how far it's true, but he was a bit of a wit, this fellow, and he told him the little bird came and sat on his shoulder and whispered in his ear. Of course, he got 14 days in the bunker for that and for the propaganda purposes. But we certainly knew about Hess.
Were punishments heavy?
Not really, not in our action. No, they were. The camp itself was about 2 or 3 miles or kilometres probably outside the town of Bromberg, Bydgoszcz. But I found out later, now again how far this is true I don't know, but we were on the edge of a huge forest. Now it would take you 4 days marching to get through this forest. And apparently the irony of it all was it previously belonged to Brian May, the match people. You know, now how far that's true I don't know, but it seemed rather ironical that here we were, Tommy's, you know, having been captured and working for the Germans in a part that had once been, you know, partly British, I might say. And I did hear, too, that deep in these forests there were Polish partisan people, but we never saw them, we never contacted them. And sometimes we had to march as up to 5 miles a day to get to our working site. Incidentally, this is where cigarettes came in handy, and if I can put this little one in here, it was a standard rule in the camp that when you fell in the morning, the right-hand marker always carried 2 or 3 cigarettes in the palm of his hand. And as you were marching through the forest on these roads, if you heard a wagon coming, he put his hand up like that, showing these cigarettes, and boy, you got to lift to work then. This is where the currency came in. These wagons, too, were all fired by wood, you know, these wood charcoal-burning things, you know, because the petrol was so short, you know. But it was quite a lift to work, you know, 5 miles there and 5 miles back and a stint in between on a third of a loaf of bread and a bowl of soup, you know, was pretty hard going. Some, of course, work very close to the camp, of course. And some, I worked for a firm called Tifo. I don't remember. We were filling skips and all sorts. It was hard work, but you got used to it, I suppose.
You're becoming more closer together, though, as a unit.
Yes, this was the start. Now, we were getting better organised. We were forming little friendships and groups and this sort of thing. And later, you know, when Red Cross started trekking through, life became more bearable. The first winter was tough, though, you see, because we never experienced a Polish winter. It's tantamount to a Russian winter, because the winds came right out of the steppes, you know, right out of the east, and boy, it was cold. Phew, I sometimes wonder how we survived. Incidentally, you were asking me, you know, how we slept in. We slept on double bunks. And when the weather was really bad, and when the coal ran out, we used to get a little ration of coal for the stove in the middle. Then every man had to sacrifice one bedboard every day to keep the fire going. So by the time April came, boy, you were sleeping on about four bedboards. But you had to keep warm. The cold was penetrating, it really was. But it was a dry cold. That was the one good thing about it. It was very like the Canadian weather. I, being a student, I knew it was a sort of a continental climate. There was no spring, no autumn. Boy, you'd wake up one morning, you know, sometime in May, in April, and you could hear everything creaking and the drip, you knew the thaw had set in, and the next day it would be 20 degrees, you know, really hot.